Lee?
How are you, sir?
I'm very well, Zach.
Thanks for taking the time to do this. We are at Andertones Music in Guilford. I didn't realize this because you watched the shows. I almost thought the store was, I guess, in proper London.
Okay.
But when you do these interviews, everybody comes out here. It's about an hour outside of town. Everybody comes out here to do them.
Yes. I mean, yes. If you're from the US,
we're ignorant.
The UK is far more compressed. So Guildford is a town with a population of about 150,000 people. And then if you travel like 30 minutes north, you hit London, Greater London. So that's where obviously, you know. So I some people would say Guildford is a suburb of London, but British people would go, no, it's not. It's just its own separate town. And then if you go another sort of 30 miles south, you hit the south coast. It's a very densely populated country. I think there's a stat, isn't there, that you could fit the UK into Minnesota. Minnesota's the state, right?
Or is it
the town? Yeah. You could fit the UK and Minnesota about five times, and there's something like the population of Minnesota is like a tenth of the UK or something like
that. There's nobody in Minnesota. Sorry to all our Minnesota listeners.
But yes, we're not far from London, but we're not London.
Yeah, so do most people who shop here live in Guildford? And from the store, most people shop out of the store? Or do people commute out here
No, I think they commute. I mean, in the UK, there are, I don't know, half a dozen really great destination guitar stores. And because the UK is so relatively small, you know, it doesn't matter whether you live in, you could live in Birmingham, which is kind of like halfway up the country. You could live in Bristol, which is quite far west. You know, obviously you could live in London and you can be in Guildford within a couple of hours. So we get people from all over who will, you know, take a day out to drive down. And the southeast of England has quite a high density of sort of good guitar stores. So there's a couple of competitors of ours that aren't too far away. And we always said, you know, if you could hit that golden triangle, you could probably see 5,000 guitars in a day. You know, it's like, if you can't find the guitar you like, you know.
You're the problem. Yeah, if you can't find the guitar.
If you've only seen 5,000 of them, then yeah. I think it's, people will, you know, especially for a higher value purchase, you know, people want to make sure they're getting the right thing. So they'll jump in the car. And if it takes them a day to do the round trip, that's okay.
It's worth it.
Yep.
I was watching this video where you were talking about East Coast guitars, mm-hmm. which you're involved in, which is like budget friendly entry level guitars.
Yeah.
You were talking about how when you were working on designing them, $5 basically brought mm-hmm. the whole level of the guitar up significantly compared to maybe other guitars on the market in that price range. What does $5 buy you in a budget guitar?
So, yeah, the East Coast is a brand that it's probably a bit of a stretch to say we design them. We work with a factory that makes guitars for lots of different companies, and so they'll have a core catalog of shapes and things that you can choose from. But yeah, you'll get to say, do you know, could we change the pickup selector for a better one, or change the tuners for a better one, or do some. It's that level of design, right? Not, you know, full how Fender might design a new guitar. I think you'd be amazed, like how little the upcharge is to go from Laurel to Rosewood on a fretboard, or from an awful five-way selector to maybe not necessarily like a Switchcraft one or something like that, but just like a bet. It's 50 cents to just double the quality of a five-way selector, 50 cents to double the quality of a volume pot or something like that. It's quite mind-blowing sometimes when you see, you know, the entire price of an East Coast guitar is a third of the price of a good overdrive pedal. You know, it's like in your mind, you're going, that can't be right.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's like just, but, you know, I guess ultimately, if you're building guitars in a country that has very low labor costs and access to phenomenal amounts of resource, you know, I mean, componently, China makes everything, you know, they've got, again, I don't want to, I try and step away from the sort of the politics of it all. I'm not educated enough to really understand. I just know what is on offer. And I know that, yeah, we've had, I'm super proud of what we've done with East Coast. And I say proud, maybe that's a bit grandiose again, but you know, the objective...
No, you can be proud. Why can't you be proud?
The objective was to go, what's the best start we can give a beginner guitar player? And, you know, and take into account the fact that the person buying it, whether it's the individual or their parents or whatever like that, is going, oof, this might be a 5-minute wonder, so I don't want to spend tons of money. And we took that everything. We took that into the amp and everything. It was like, I was obsessed with this idea that I can't bear amps that you see some kids start with that just literally sound like a wasp in a jam jar. I just think, why would you want to make that noise? You know, it's like, it's horrible. So again, we did it, you know, we really tried to, we were like, no, we'll pay the extra dollar that it costs to put reverb in an amplifier, and we'll pay the extra dollar to have the 2-inch slightly bigger speaker, or, you know, it's like, that was a weird, the factory just, that was probably the hardest thing, was because there's a big language barrier, obviously, between Chinese factory and a UK company. The factory just started, but all we ever get told by everyone else is, how can we do this cheaper? You know, and we were like...
That's what the factory said. Yeah. The factory says to you, everybody wants to do this cheaper and cheaper and cheaper.
So we've got this new cheaper this new... And we're going, I don't want the cheaper this. I want the slightly better version of this. But hey, we got... It's not that... You know, eventually you get over that sort of... slightly, you know, they're just not used to that dynamic, and now they are used to it, and it's fine. And I'll show you some before we go. We've got like this T-style bound, just a wicked guitar. When you knocked on the door, I was playing like this.
Yeah.
And I even now, we've been doing East Coast for probably 10 years. I'm just like, I can't believe this is £99. What a great...
So what are the main things that are... that really make the impact in making the guitar feel a step above something else in the market? So it's the switch. You want a switch that feels really good.
Well, it's the neck and the fretwork.
The neck and the fretwork.
Yeah.
That goes a long way, yeah.
I guarantee, I'll hand you an East Coast guitar before you go, and I guarantee you'll go, I can't, this is not a $99 neck and fret. And it's like, well, yeah, it is. And then it's little bits, like, you know, yeah, just a slightly nicer switch, some slightly nicer tuners, things like that. I'm probably Trem Systems is where you start to find the price of a good one probably doesn't work on a $99. You know, it would drive the price up, particularly if you want to start looking at, you know, some great value hardware from people like Wilkinson and stuff like that. But you have to be, you know, a $6 or $7 Trem system versus a $2 Trem system or something like that probably does start to go, I'm going to be tough to keep this under the $99 price. So, you know, so it doesn't matter on a T style because there's no moving parts as such. But yeah, I think the Trem system on our $99 guitars is probably typical of one of those, like, it looks like a Trem system, but I wouldn't start doing any
jimmy. Don't dive on the gig if you want to say it.
But no, I like I say, that's the objective, right? Because no one's going to buy a $99 guitar, play that for 50 years and go, thank you, $99 guitar.
You know,
it's just got to serve a purpose. It's just got to give you the bug, get you through that the hardest part of being a guitar player, which is that first 6 months or so. And I just didn't want the instrument to be any part of the reason why you decided to give up. You know, I didn't want it. Yeah. Oh, God, it never stays in tune. It's really uncomfortable. It's like there'll be a multitude of other reasons why you give up. but I didn't want the instrument to be one of them. And depressingly, you know, I mean, certainly on the music stores, actually, on the whole, are pretty good about making sure their entry level instrument is good. If the trouble is, if you're not a big enough music store to do your own thing, like a Harley Benton or a East Coast or whatever like that, you're going to do a Squire or a Yamaha. And unfortunately, those brands just will never be as economical to buy or sell as an own brand. You know, there's too many middlemen trying to earn their slice out of it, which is fine, you know. So I think the depressing ones are when non-music stores go, you know, oh, guitars seem popular at the moment. This factory will sell us a guitar that we can retail for $59. Oh, and look, with an amp, it's only $79. Go and buy 10,000 of those, you know.
Yeah.
Boom. And it's just like, oh, that's it. Just, I've never played one that didn't feel awful. And if I was a kid learning to play and I couldn't get the thing to stay in tune and all that kind of stuff, I'm sure you'd pretty quickly get frustrated with it and go, oh, I'll go back to my PlayStation or...
Yeah, right, whatever. Right. Does anyone buy them and use them for parts? Like, does anyone buy the one and use a body and put a neck on it and like...
I think, you know, there's a big market, I think. There's a big community, sorry, not market, who just like to mod guitars. So I'm never convinced that it's... I'm never convinced that you end up with a guitar that's actually better than had you just gone and... You know, like you bought this guitar for $99, then you spend another $100 on parts or whatever. And I'm never, you know, spend 20 hours doing it. I'm never that convinced that you end up with a guitar that you couldn't have just gone and found for $250 and bought anyway. But I think people do it as a hobby, like, you know, making models or whatever like that. You know, they just enjoy it. And the East Coast stuff is, yeah, it's got a good body, good neck, good fretwork. Change everything else if you want to. It will certainly be better. I don't think that's, I mean, for me, it's the entry level, you know, it's the beginner community that is the biggest purchasers of that kind of guitar. I think credit to Harley Benton, the guys in the German guys, they've managed to get the customer to accept that actually you might spend $300 or $400 on a Harley Benton now, rather than looking at a Fender or an Epiphone or whatever like that. They've invested a lot of time and energy in that brand. East Coast for us, I think that's not really our objective. I mean, our objective is we sort of, once we hit that sort of $200 sort of mark, we kind of go, okay, we'll let the big guys take over now. You know, there's a certain... who doesn't want a guitar that says
the something
at the top, right? You know, so
something that your hero played.
That's exactly it. You know, you move into that sort of more aspirational nature at that point. But yeah, look, it's I'm really pleased with I think we'll just carry on doing that thing with East Coast, sticking to that mantra that it's just about making sure it's the best possible guitar that we can do for you to start on. Boom.
Yeah.
That would be perfect.
How do you think about, as a store, when a kid comes in and buys his first guitar, you've got to be thinking, okay, this is either going to be a customer for life or we're never going to see him again because it's not going to stick. How do you think about, I don't even know, trying to create some kind of environment or system where you can get as many kids sticking with the guitar or any instrument as possible?
If you want a successful music store, and you have to accept that the value from a customer is a lifetime value. It's not, I mean, look, if we sell a guitar for $99, right, we're obviously going to make a profit on that guitar of something. But if that's all we ever get from you, I've probably barely paid for an hour of a salesman's time, let alone managed to run a business on it. What we need is for as many of those new starter customers as possible to become lifer guitar players. And, you know, I mean, I don't know what the lifetime value is. It's going to vary, isn't it, depending on the circumstances of each individual. But it's certainly not going to be less than $5,000 in a year, in a lifetime, sorry.
Fender says, it's, you know, I think it's 10,000 per customer for them.
I mean, yeah. I suspect that average is anything, you know, it could be 100,000 for some customers. Maybe 5,000 is, I don't know, in a lifetime. It's pretty easy to spend $5,000 in a lifetime on guitars and pedals and amps. And
I spend $5,000 in one day.
I know. So that's the objective, right? I mean, that's essentially, and that's what, whether you're selling guitars, making guitars, repairing guitars, teaching guitars, you know, we all need the same thing to happen. So, that's the objective. And I think what that shaped in Andersons, and I never ever understood going into a guitar store and seeing, I think the worst one ever was, and I won't say where it was, but it was in a very high profile sort of location for guitars.
No, say where it was. No, I'm just kidding.
And there'd be like a loop wire going through the guitar. She was obviously like an anti-theft.
Yeah.
And then literally a skull and crossbones on every single guitar with a warning about what would happen if you touched it.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I mean, if you look around here, right, we're in the section of the guitar store where all the good stuff is, all right? And absolutely everything is, you can pick it up, try it. And I've never understood, why wouldn't you want the experience of coming into a guitar store to inspire people to go, oh, I've never tried one of those before.
Yeah.
You know, so we've got the silent practice rooms. We've got the policy of, you know, you can try anything. I kind of feel like, you know, you're obviously trying to avoid damaging the guitars. So it's like, you know, yes, we'd probably like you to ask someone if you could pick something up, but no one's going to say no. They're always going to go, no problem, let me get this down for you. It doesn't sound like a terribly, you know, sophisticated, unbelievable, wow, I never thought about doing that. It sounds pretty obvious, right? You want to try and make the experience of coming into a guitar store inviting and welcoming and inspiring and all those kind of things. And yet still, so many stores get that wrong.
Yeah. The store that I went to when I was a kid in New York, they would never let you play the guitars. Mm. But then I look back on it and I go, of course, because I was like in middle school and I probably would have scratched them or something. Don't you think about that? Or you go, that's the price to pay for creating a welcoming environment in the store.
I mean, it's obviously a balance, but you know, for the most of the store where you've got like, you know, the Squire display and the Epiphone display and the Mexican Fender, when you buy the guitar, that's not the one you're going to get, right? You're going to go, oh, I like that. You're going to get a seal. So to a degree, I don't mind as how...
Those are the floor models.
Yeah, if that gets a few scratches on it, but simultaneously, you know, 50 kids come in and go, oh, God, Dad, I got to play a proper Fender Strat today.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like, and you know, that's all I want for Christmas now.
That's
got to be worth...
Yeah.
You know, one model with a couple of scratches on it, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I guess if as a music shop, all you stock is like crazy high end, one of a kind, maybe you have to take a slightly different attitude. But yeah, as a sort of general music store, it's like, I don't know. I think you just like, come on in.
Try
it's
stuff.
Like so many other things that, you know, can you imagine? I know, imagine any other retail store. Imagine going into like a computer game store, you know, and look at the effort they got. And you go, don't touch the,
Anything,
you can't play anything.
Yeah,
it's like,
exactly.
It's like, I don't know. I mean, it's what I've all, that's how I always wanted Andertons to be. And I was lucky in that that was the environment I grew up in. And that was kind of probably when I first started. That was what the store manager here had a similar ethos. I think it's just culturally, it's always been quite ingrained in the Andertons thing. You know, let's try and even down to, I'm not going to deny that when I first started and probably for the first 10 years or so like that, this industry was not, misogynistic is maybe slightly too extreme, but it was an intimidating play, you know. All the staff would be guys there, you know, you'd hear the comments if a girl came in and that sort of stuff. And you're like, I've got to just can't have that. You know, there's just people have just got to come in with a shared love of an interest in music, whether it's keyboards or guitars or whatever like that. They've just got to feel like they can ask about anything. Could be a really novice question, could be an advanced question. They've got to be able to try stuff and everything is about breaking down any reason why somebody might feel embarrassed or intimidated to sort of come in. I don't know that necessarily we're there yet, but it's massively, massively better than it was 25 years ago. At least in here it is anyway.
So. Yeah. Lee, when you go to something like NAMM, when I go to NAMM, I feel like I'm there to kind of like goof off, hang out with friends. Like NAMM is not for me because I'm not a dealer.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to NAMM, what do you do at NAMM day to day? And is it that valuable for you to go to NAMM? Does it really make a difference? Or do you even go to NAMM? Yeah, I've seen you at NAMM a couple times. Yeah.
I don't think I've apart from COVID, I think that's the only NAMMs I've missed in maybe the last 25 years or so. So NAMM, historically, do you remember that world where there wasn't an internet? NAMM was how you found out about everything that was going to be new at the beginning of the year. So that was the timing. You know, you get through Christmas, you have your sort of seasonal peak, you're a bit knackered, you go to California, it's nice and sunny, and your bank balance has got loads of dough in it because you've just had Christmas. And so all the suppliers are going, let me show you what's new. And it was great. And you'd see your friends and there'd be some parties in the evening and the weather was nicer than the UK. Anyway. And then the internet came along and, you'd go to NAMM and you'd go, oh yeah, you told me about that. I saw that on the internet 3 weeks ago. You sent me an email about that too. I've already ordered those. I've done that. Da, 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 da. And I think NAMM since then, NAMM, not the trade organization, I'm just talking about the show, I think has sort of gone, what actually is this for? So of course now it's much more consumer focused. So, you know, if I go back 10 or 15 years, NAMM was 90% trade. And then if you knew someone who knew someone, maybe you could get a ticket. Now it's the other way. It feels like 90% consumers and 10% trade. I'm not really sure. I think the community aspect of NAMM is an angle now for them. I guess the issue is how important is that for the exhibitors? It's blimmin' expensive to exhibit and to go to NAMM. You know, and if you're not going to write any orders because you've written them all anyway, what value do you put on just being able to go, oh, hi, you know, haven't seen you since the last NAMM? You know, and there is some value to that, but is it $1 million? Because that's what some of the stands are costing, you know, the big ones.
Yeah,
you know,
right. Like,
I don't know. I think it's super important that the industry has a voice like NAMM and has a reason to all get together once a year. But equally, if that's coming out of your marketing budget, it's got to be justifiable. I don't know. We will. Are we going to NAMM next year, Tay?
Taylor says yes.
We're going. I mean... It's easy for us, right? Because we're not exhibiting out there. So the cost of going is a few plane tickets. I know with other brands that I work with, and certainly the bigger ones, the cost of exhibiting at NAMM is crazy expensive. So,
but do you walk around, do you ever find something that you haven't seen and then go, oh, we should carry that in the store? And do you find those kinds of products or less and less now that everything's online?
No. We still do. I couldn't believe it. I mean,
everyone must suck up to you like crazy at NAMM, right? Because everyone wants you to buy their stuff.
Taylor confirms, yes.
We get the real answer out of Taylor.
The dynamic of walking around NAMM has gone from being 15 years ago to basically, if you had a blue badge, it basically meant that you had the authority to spend your company's money buying stuff.
Right.
So obviously, you know, so, oh, hey, how are you? Like that. And then they do the thing and then the eyes would go down to what's your name.
And they go, Lee.
So you go like, anyway, so that's what it used to be like. Now it's obviously you've got such a concentration of guitar players there. And then inevitably they're all familiar with the YouTube channel. And so, of course, they all want to, you know, tell you that, this is my favorite video you did like that. Can I get a selfie like that? Which is all great and amazing. Yeah, yeah. And then you realize that it's just taken you half an hour to walk from here to there.
You're not even in the building yet.
Yeah. And then you're sort of going like, wow, I commercially need to justify being here. And to do that, I need to try and see like, you know, 50 or 100 booths like that. And I need to do some deals and order some stuff. And if it's taken me half an hour to go from one booth to the next, I'm not going to do it. So I don't know that we've really resolved. I'm going to take the Slipknot there. I'm going to put a mask on. I don't know. It's. I think last year or the year before last, I was looking at the NAMM exhibitor list, and it's on a great big Excel spreadsheet, and it had 3,500 lines on it. And it made me just think to myself, wow, there's 3,500 companies making a living out of the music industry that have decided
to... So they say, or whatever.
But it's like some of these companies are selling the screws that hold the scratch plate,
right.
And some of them are selling insurance, and some of them are selling tuition. You know, it's not all guitar manufacturers. But it did make me think, it's a big old business like that, and I really have to try and make the effort to sort of get round and see. And yeah, there's always a new pedal builder or amp builder or guitar builder or someone that's designed a funky strap or something like that. You go, oh, you know what? That was cool. And I've never seen it before, you know. So if it wasn't for the show, you may never see that. I think the harder one to justify is, why would you go and see Fender at the NAMM show? And yet the crazy thing is, they're the guys paying the most money.
They have the biggest booth there. Yeah.
So it's like, you know, for in the UK, Andertons has literally a dedicated Fender account manager who just looks after Andertons. So we see him like every other day. We know everything about everything. What else is there for you to tell me? You know, So that's, I do sympathize with, you know, the Fender decision. Should we be there? Should we not be there? How big should we be there? And then of course, you know, it's a little bit like, a house of cards. You know, you take Fender out, you take Gibson out, you take Yamaha out, all of a sudden everyone's going, well, if they're not going to be there, why do I need to be there?
Yeah.
And that's the challenge for NAMM. You know, it's like, got to come up with a compelling reason to be there. I don't know. I've never been on the board of NAMM, so I'm not sure what conversations are going around, but I think everything should be like, why Los Angeles? Why January? Why the format that it is? You know, that I think that potentially it would be nice to see that changed up from time to time. It would certainly make it easier for us if it was an East Coast event rather than a West Coast event. You know, I mean, it's a long flight, a massive time difference for a 3 or 4 day event.
You know? Some selfies also.
Yeah. I mean, look, I've never come back from NAMM going, oh God, I hated that. I never want to go again.
Yeah.
You know, I've come back from NAMM going, I'm absolutely knackered and I'm not sure what value we got out of that.
Yeah, right. But are there any gear companies, even in this modern age, that are really accessible over in Europe that maybe you can't find as easily in America?
Oh, wow.
Like, I was talking with someone about Hudson Electronics that we don't really...
Do you not?
You could get them because you can kind of get everything, but they're super rare. You really don't see them very often.
Let me just think. I think what's interesting in the US, and this is... Obviously, I've been fortunate to be involved with Chapman and Victory over the years. I was really surprised how averse retailers in the US are to trying to deal with a company where the currency is different or the shipping from another, you know, they do literally just want to be, they just want to go to their local distributor, be told what the price is in dollars, be told they can order one and it'll be there tomorrow, have a bit of credit, you know. And so if you're a European or I suppose a non-US manufacturer who as yet hasn't decided to go through distribution or hasn't found a distributor that wants to do it, yeah, so that surprised me because I think that in Europe, we're so used to dealing with companies where they want to get paid in dollars or they want to get paid in whatever their local currency is. And we've got to organize the freight to come in. And, I was a bit surprised given that the US is by some distance the biggest music market in the world. I think it's certainly on guitars and stuff. It's like 50% of the global market is US based. So I was a bit surprised that retailers were I don't even know that it, I don't know what the right word is. Just, it's just, it was so alien to them to just go, oh, sorry, I have to, what currency? And there's a, and obviously tariffs has been a huge hot topic. I mean, there's always been tariffs.
Yeah.
So there's always been the paperwork to do, but up until fairly recently, they were, you know, it was like 2 or 3%, you know, not 25% or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. So it's, that's probably the reason why maybe some brands feel like, oh, it's hard to get in the US or you don't see them. It's just that I've found dealers in the US are quite averse to, they literally want their local rep from their trusted distribution company to come around and go, oh, by the way, we're now stocking Hudson. Do you want to buy any of these? I mean, Hudson's a strange, you know, obviously their most famous artist is Ariel Posen.
Yeah.
I know he's not American and I know he'll get terribly upset if anybody, but you know, he's sort of roughly from that neck of the woods.
You can get the pedals in America. It's like someone on the internet could be like, I have one and I'm American. Like you can get them, but you never really see them stocked in stores. So you either probably get them on Reverb or you get them directly from.
Yeah. I think with, again, I'd have to double check with my purchasing team, but that I recollect that a brand like Hudson, it's a small builder.
Yeah.
So typically what we're doing is we're choosing a pedal. We might do a color run and then we'll order 50 of them and that will last us for 2 months or something like that. And I think that's what you have to do. So obviously lots of smaller stores will just go, I just want to get two, right? You know, and then I think that's probably just like, well, that's not an option, sort of doubly so if you're in the US. What are my favorite pedals from over here? Obviously I'm going to say Thorpe, but I know you can get those in America. Hudson is great. What other great British pedal manufacturers are there? Victory make pedals, I should say that, obviously. That's always, I've thought, funny. Like, the US do guitars brilliantly, and then the UK does amps brilliantly. And then, I mean, pedal market's a bit of everything, isn't it? Every country seems
like,
to
do you have a lot of Analog Man pedals over here? Like, in the US, that's a boutique builder, but I feel like everybody has an Analog Man on their board. Do you get them over here?
Only if you buy it direct from Analog Man.
Yeah, yeah.
His King of Tone is, as far as I'm aware, there's still a year plus waiting list if you want a new one. So, of course, you dive on Reverb and you pay double what the new one costs. That's how you get one. It's all a bit crazy and bonkers, really, isn't it? But Chase Bliss is kind of the same. You know, I mean, I do admire... I do admire the guys at Chase Bliss. You know, they had the balls to sort of say, we're just going to go for this on a direct model.
Yeah.
We don't need distribution. We don't need retail. We're just going for it on our own. And, you know, if it's successful, it's going to be brilliant for them. And if they hit a tough time, there's no support network. There's nobody to sort of go, oh, I'll help you promote this. You know, it's just like they've just got there on their own. But they're doing great, which is amazing.
Last chance to shout out a pedal. From over here.
It's awful, that, isn't it? I would need to be sat in front of my pedal cabinet to sort of have a look, but I would say Origin Effects.
Origin Effects.
Yeah, Cali 76, Origin Effects.
I feel like
great compressor pedal.
Yeah.
I think you can get those in, I think they are distributed in the US.
I think you can get them over there, yeah.
Yeah, good. That is top quality British engineering. Great pedals, beautifully made, you know, reassuringly expensive.
Yeah, right.
That's a shout. That's not new. I don't think we've got a really new British. I don't think there's been like a really new British. That's been tough, sort of. It does feel like that pedal bubble has burst a little bit over the last 3 or 4 years. It's like that relentless anybody from the big guns like Keeley and JHS and Boss and stuff like that, right down to the guy who's just decided to solder some stuff up in his garage. He's gone, here's my new version of a tube screamer. You know, and then the world...
With all the mids removed, but it's a tube screamer.
And then the world goes mad for it. And all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, you know, that bubble has burst, I think. Now people are just going, I just don't need another modded tube screamer. So, and if I do want a tube screamer, I'll just buy the Ibanez one.
You said in an interview, I think this was like several years ago, but you said in an interview that you wish you started a pedal company like 20 years ago. Do you still feel that way?
How do I say this without deeply offending the pedal building community? I think the pedal is the simplest product to make of
everything in the line. Yeah.
Guitars are complicated to make. Amps are complicated to make. Pedals, I can literally feel the animosity coming from all that, you know, Robert Keeley and Josh Smith, everybody.
I think you're right, though, which is not to take anything away from the craft of the simplicity.
Not designing them, right? Designing them, I guess you need to be clever to design them. But fundamentally, you buy a metal box and you drill holes in it and you put PCB in it and you go, da-da.
Yeah.
And I think, yes. So I think a lot of people have built very successful companies very quickly and done very well out of the pedal market. I will say no more other than, yes, I wish I'd started a pedal company 20 years ago.
But now it's too late, you think? Because now it's overcrowded and now it's like there's so many.
It's everything. I'm too old. It's overcrowded. I don't know. My expertise, God, that sounds grandiose. I've been very lucky that I've sort of felt like I've gone, I think there's an opportunity to do something here. And then I've managed to find people who are good at designing things. And I've managed to go, okay, can we do something together? And maybe I'll help with some sales and marketing. But so, yeah, I do not have any expertise in how to build the next pedal. And I'm pretty sure over the next 5 years, I bet you all the best-selling pedals over the next 5 years, despite everything I've said, will be the next modified tube screamer that everybody. Oh, John Mayer's using the next piece, like, you know, and the next modified blues breaker. And
I'm always surprised that like the pedals that you see on everyone's board now are the same pedals basically that you saw 10 years ago. Like everybody still uses the timeline. You still see a million tube screamers. You still see, you know, there's a lot of archers. You see a lot of carbon copies. Like, I feel like for as much innovation as there is, it's like people also keep using the same stuff.
I read a really interesting interview with Ola Strandberg the other day. And Ola, definitely, I mean, I think he, by some distance, is the most innovative electric guitar builder that there is. You know, I mean, he's really looked at everything from neck profiles to body shapes to hardware to, you know, he's innovating. And he was talking about digital, you know, Quad Cortex, Kemper, that kind of thing. And he was saying, and I thought this was really insightful. He thinks that it's almost disappointing that all we're using digital technology for at the moment is just to try and sound like something we've already made. You know, it's like, can we just try and... And he was saying he thinks the opportunity for, as in the future of guitar, is for digital to provide a whole new palette of tools for guitar players to sound like stuff we've never sounded like before. And you go, well, that's interesting, because I don't know how that, you know, clearly that's not going to appeal to the guitar player that just wants to do Led Zeppelin covers. But there's the new, you know, the opportunity is like to go, well, imagine what happened to the guitar community the first time somebody realized you could make your amp distort?
Yeah.
And everyone went, holy shit, I've never heard this before. And then boom. So I think it's like, well, what happens when that next thing happens that we don't know what it is yet, but that digital enables? And I thought that was an interesting observation. You know, whether that's something personally as a guitar player I would ever want to do, I don't know, but I'm sure there'll be a bucket load of 15-year-old guitar players who they'll find this thing and be like, boom, that's it, explodes, something new. And then I think that's kind of And the industry needs that, you know, not just so that individuals are find new creative things to do, but yeah, how many more modified tube screens?
Yeah. You know? With all the stuff that you buy, is there anything, and you kind of answered it a little bit right there, but is there anything you see where you think there's room for innovation in this world? Like, is there anything that you think needs to be improved upon or built that hasn't been built, or an easier amp model to navigate?
I think we're a bit stuck at the moment because it does feel like the objective over the last 10 years has been to just make something good, just smaller and cheaper. How do I just get a 100-watt plexi with a 4x12 into something that's this big, that's $99? That seems to be the sort of direction of travel for innovation, which isn't hugely healthy from a, I always go back to when I first started in Andertons, the digital recording revolution was just kicking off. So we went from, you know, tape machines and all that kind of stuff to ADAT and then to little digital consoles and all that kind of stuff. And for a short while, it was amazing because instead of having to spend $50,000 or $100,000 to put a home studio together, or a professional studio, sorry. I'm not even sure home studio existed,
yeah. But
a professional studio. It then became like, oh, actually for $5,000, I can put a home studio together. You then fast forward that 10 years or 15 years, it was like, it's all free. You just buy them. Have you got a laptop? Yeah. Well, then just open the free software that it came with.
Yeah.
Have you got some headphones and a microphone? Yeah.
You do it for $200.
You've got a home studio then, haven't you? And I worry slightly that, you know, that's the path that, not with guitars, but for amplification and pedals and stuff, you know, that's the path. You know, at what point are you just going to go, well, I've got an iPhone and there's this 99 cents or pence app. Click. Oh, every amp, every pedal ever, can't tell the difference between the real thing and this. You know, that will have a relatively devastating impact on the music industry as we know it. So I think it is important that you've got to try and constantly strive for something new and better, rather than cheaper and simpler.
Yeah.
I do wonder whether or not, you know, that you normally you have this sort of pendulum that goes between, digital has been here for a long time now. You know, there was a period during the sort of the 80s, I think, where guitar players sort of found digital alternatives to rack gear. It just wasn't very good. And so eventually, but I do wonder that I think is the challenge for digital, because all the time they're sort of going, well, it's certainly much more convenient. I get that. And it's almost as good. You know, it's like you literally, the audience can't hear the difference. You might feel it, you know, it's like it's
that video you did with like Rob Chapman though, where you were ABing like Boogie.
Yeah.
A real Boogie, and then you had all these simulators. Yeah. He kind of knew instantly, and then he sort of second-guessed himself, and he thought, I think it was the quad cortex you were using, he sort of second-guessed himself, and then he was like, no, that's the real amp. Like, he knew instantly what it was.
Yeah, funnily enough, I actually think that it's not the bit that produces the sound that is the weak link in the chain at the moment. It's the speaker you hear it through.
Yeah.
It's the, you're like, you know, if you have a proper guitar cabinet with a good guitar speaker in it, 4x12, 1x12, whatever. I am yet to hear an FRFR cabinet with a great IR through it, side by side, that sounds even close, if I'm honest with you. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't sound good, or I'm not trying to make a good, bad observation. I'm just going, I've downloaded the IR of that Marshall 4x12 and I'm listening to it through that FRFR cab, and it doesn't sound anything like that in the room. I appreciate that if you're playing to an audience and it's all going through front of house, different argument.
consistency in, every night. If yeah, that's what
a
you
different
want.
Argument. Yeah. But in the room. So I don't know. There's part of, I suppose this is a very long-winded way of saying, I wonder if at some point people will go, well, I've done the digital thing, I've bought all the stuff, da 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 da. Do you know what? I just fancy an amp again with a couple of pedals.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's kind of what we've done before. But I don't know. I mean, the technology is so much better than it was the last time that happened. Maybe it won't. I look at cameras, you know, will we ever go back to loading film into a camera, because it's still the best.
Yeah, right,
you
know? Right.
Or will you just go, it's just so much more convenient just to get my iPhone, click, share it, boom.
Yeah.
And I'm only ever going to look at the photo on the screen of the iPad anyway, so I'm never going to get the benefit of the what I might get with film.
Yeah.
So...
It's funny, though, because I remember having a Line 6 pod when I was a kid and thinking, this sounds amazing. And now you look back and that was so primitive that I'm curious if we're going to feel like the modelers today are super primitive when we look back.
Well, I can guarantee you that that's what you'll be told, because how are we going to sell you? And I say we, I'm grouping us into how are we going to sell you
the next thing,
Quad Cortex Mark 5? If we don't tell you that the Quad Cortex Mark 1 doesn't, it sounds terrible, relatively speaking. So part of what you've said about the pod is true. You know, it's like, yes, the tone has moved on. And part of it is just, well, that's obviously what the industry is going to tell you.
Yeah.
I think that's a huge challenge for the fact that a Deluxe Reverb from the 1960s still sounds amazing, and a Les Paul from 1959 is still amazing, is not great, right, commercially, because we as a retail industry, you know, we want to give you a reason to go, no, get rid of that, buy the new one.
Yeah. You know? Isn't it crazy, like, if you talk to, like, an amp tech who talks about modern amps, let's say, we'll leave brand names out of it, a lot of the times they'll say, you know, if they put a 50-cent filter cap in this amp, it would improve it 10 times or whatever. And they just don't do that, so many of them. Isn't that crazy that
I haven't had a lot of experience with Far Eastern stuff, but with the Victory guys, I would say most of the time when I've gone, why can't we do that? And I'm harking back to perhaps a more vintage circuit. It's health and safety reasons. It's like those kinds of designs or components just aren't legal anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And you get...
Interesting.
And you get a few really small boutique builders who are so small, they fly under that radar. So they just... So that's why I think there is that, you know, there's so much love for some of these really small boutique builders, but they just can't upscale, because as soon as their head goes above a certain level, it'll just be like, you don't have the certificate, you know. You
yeah,
can't.
Right, right. That's an interesting point.
But equally as well, I think on the Far Eastern stuff, and I think it is depressing really, but I see a lot of decisions made to save a dollar here or 50 cents here, because if you make 20,000 of them, that's $20,000, you know, and you go, wow, I think you're missing the picture here, that if you'd have just put that slightly better speaker in, you'd have sold three times as many amplifiers, you know, but I don't know. I think if you need to talk to brands like Boss and Fender and stuff, where the scale is just completely different to anything I've ever been involved with. And then I suppose, you know, you take that save 50 cents thing, find 10 ways to save 50 cents on a product, sell 100,000 of those products. Whoever made that decision, there's $500,000 worth of, you know, extra profit for the company, you know. It's like, have a bonus. I don't know. It's probably not an environment that I would excel in. You know, I think I'd always be trying to lean towards, but we could just, I don't know. It's very competitive out there, isn't it? And I'm sure brands are paranoid about going, but if we do this, 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 and this, it's going to make the product $30 more expensive. And we've got to be up against Boss Katana or Squire X. Won't fly. And don't know.
Is the GP200 still your favorite modeler?
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? I feel incredibly lucky on that Vailton thing, because we we got to know the Vailton guys about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. They're a lovely bunch of people. There's something to do with, I don't fully understand it, but there's something to do with Hotone or Hot One or however you pronounce that. So they're like,
nobody knows.
They're like an offshoot of that, but that if you lead back to the top, I think it's the same people. And then they released GP200, and I just, it was so, I hate, you know, here's the new XYZ. Preset number one. Oh God, it's garbage. I'm almost like, I can't be bothered to find out what this thing does now. She's like, if you can't make preset number one sound good.
Yeah, right,
like,
right.
You've lost me already. And like Vailton was like, preset number one was like, oh my God, it sounds amazing. Like, you know, so, and now I want to explore and see what the other buttons do. So anyway, we did well with that. And pretty quickly I was able to go to Vailton and say, look, you know, I really like this product, but if you really, really want Andertons to get excited about it and promote it, I need some sort of guarantee that we'll have some of the exclusive rights to sell this product in the UK. We were just lucky because they were a small company at the time. They didn't have many people selling it anyway, so I don't think it was a big deal for them to say okay. So they said okay. And then they've just hit a vein, you know. GP5 has been absolutely huge. There's a couple more products building on that GP5 technology that I'm sure are going to be huge. I will keep, every time I plug into it and preset number one,
preset
goes,
one sounds
here
good.
It is, you know, then I'm like, I'm in. I will, and you know, and again, that's just, there are some massive, massive guitar effects companies out there. And I talk to them and they will spend 2 years designing a product and then there'll be pressure from above to go, got to get this over the line, guys, got to release this like that. And then literally we'll spend a week doing the presets because that's like, got to get it. We had to be at NAMM. Da, da, da,
yeah,
da,
right.
And you're just like, oh my God. It's like, it's just such a fail.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
There's a perfectly good product here that, you
and
know,
nobody knows because the presets
suck.
Yeah,
and like,
or
if you try the first five, if you go five presets, it's like, still haven't found a good one. It's like, why would you? Why would you make the effort to go, I'll just reprogram the whole thing and to try and find the
especially
good sound?
Especially when I already have my sounds programmed. Yeah. I need to go reprogram something to get good sounds. It's like, I want to be inspired out of the gate with it, right?
Yeah. So, we shall see. There's so much good stuff coming. You know, I mean, the Neural have got, Neural, I know, have got software versions coming over the next, you know, few months or whatever that's going to keep driving what that product can do. Helix have got the long-awaited stadium, which looks amazing. You're always waiting for Boss to throw some sort of hand grenade into the mix because I'm sure they could if they wanted to. The Fractal guys are making amazing stuff. You know, there's tons of stuff. Tons of stuff.
Okay, wrapping up, you're like the king of guitar YouTube, one of the first guys to really explode on it. How much opportunity is there now on YouTube? And for you, like, YouTube is a top of funnel thing to really support the store. If you don't have a store, do you think you can make enough revenue just on YouTube to support yourself, or is it really hard?
Gosh, well, we kind of talked a little bit about that before we started rolling. And I certainly think one of the guiding principles that Andertons has for its YouTube channel is it's fundamentally here to make people aware of the wider business and to hopefully inspire people to want to shop with Andertons. So yes, in a nutshell, just from ad revenue on YouTube, our channel does not even break even compared to what it costs to make the videos. So it's very much about supporting the wider business. And I think also as well, that's our kind of lane. There's a certain amount of, you know, I know what I'm doing, or the team knows what they're doing here. And even though you know, we see channels like, you know, Rick Beato's has exploded. And I don't think Rick was doing videos when we first started. So there's a certain hell we could have gone down that route. And, you know, there's tuition guys like, you know, Music is Win and Paul Davids. And then there's more just sort of, I think, sort of general interest stuff, like the stuff that perhaps Mary Spender's doing. And so we could have gone lots of different paths. And clearly all those people I mentioned are making a good living out of what YouTube has enabled them to do. So we're going to stay in our lane, you know, and we're going to just try and keep with this sort of community. I don't want to get involved in, I definitely don't want to be a channel that gets involved in drama, you know, and I don't want the channel necessarily to become, I don't know, too, don't want to get political or anything like that. The nugget for me is, and what I hope our YouTube channel does beyond telling you what the new XYZ is the joy of making music with someone else. So that's why I always liked the two presenter thing, because that's the joy, right? You know, even this, it's like, I find it, I've done the, here we are straight to camera, I'm on my own, I'm going to tell you about this. But it never conveys the real joy and fun of being able to play a guitar and being in a room with another person who can play the guitar. Or drums or whatever like that. And just the fun, you know, and I'm not hugely interested necessarily in becoming the best guitar player that I can be. I'd like to be a better guitar player and I will put some effort into that. But it's the joy. And I sort of feel like that's what the Andertons channel hopefully does, is you watch 20 minutes of an Andertons video and you go, those two look like they're having fun. And that pedal sounds cool. And it's my birthday next week. Yeah. So I'm going to send an email to my mum going, can you get me this pedal from Andertons, please, mum?
Yeah.
That's the, you know, if we can go tick, tick, tick to those three things, then we're winning. And if someone is sitting there today going, oh, do you know, I want to try and make some YouTube videos. You want to try and find an angle that no one else is doing and, you know, find your, but that sounds so cliche. And what even is that angle anymore? You know, it's just like, well, you're doing good, you know, and you're finding people to interview and you're asking interesting questions and that, you know, so I think there's always an angle. I don't personally like this sense that everything is being pressured to do it shorter and faster and more concise and snappier. And, you know, I like the slightly more relaxed environment that I think YouTube gives compared to say TikTok or something like that. Oh, look, it's inevitable. In 5 years' time, there'll be someone else who's achieved the same sort of level of success that Rick or Paul or Mary have achieved, and we've never heard of them now.
Yeah.
So it will happen.
Have you changed your opinion on that? Because I've heard you say in an interview, I think maybe from like 2021 or something, that I think you were saying that if you didn't start when you started, when it was just, there was just less noise, it was easier to break through. Do you have a different opinion about that now?
I wouldn't just copy. Yeah, 100%. I mean, I wouldn't just go, oh, I'm going to start a channel where me and another guy from Denmark talk about guitars and hope that that goes okay.
Yeah.
It's just like, I think that, yeah, I'm not sure in which universe that ever becomes hugely successful. But I mean, look, you'll find some, you know what though, I say that. I am, one of the things I think I've been talking with Taylor about over the last year or so is just going, somehow or other, the Andertons channel needs to transcend the familiar faces like me, Pete, Rob, what, you know, and it has to become a thing of its own because, you know, I'm 50 something now and I'm sure if I was 19, would I really care what a 50 something year old guy was talking about? I'd probably want to find another 19 year old that wanted to talk about a pedal. So I suppose there's inevitably, yeah, new faces will appear on YouTube doing the same thing, but relating to a different audience. So I think with Anderton's, you know, I need to try and make sure that, you know, that I would like the channel to feel like it has a variety of personalities, all from different backgrounds and with different views on stuff, and that they can have their voice and say their thing. I don't know if there's enough hours in the day, is there, Tay, to necessarily achieve that. But yeah, I wouldn't have said objective is maybe the wrong word, but it's a train of thought at the moment that actually, you know, at some point, who cares what I think anymore?
You obsess over like upload times and like only putting out a certain amount of content every day, or do you think there, or whatever, do you guys just, you say when a video is ready, it goes up and that's it basically?
I don't know if we might all have slightly different opinions on that. I'm just going to talk for myself now, if you like, but I just go, all I see with YouTube is if the concept was good, it gets lots of views. And if the concept was not poor, but it's not good or bad. It's if it's an interesting subject, it gets lots of views. So Fender have just released the most amazing Stratocaster ever, you know, da 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 da, interesting. This bass string manufacturer has done a new flat wound version of it's like not very interesting. I mean, interesting to some people, but not what. That's all I really see that really drives the difference between a lot of views and not very many views. It's not the time of day, the day of the week, the frequency of the upload. We very, very occasionally get a video that trends on YouTube, and I'm not sure any of us really understand why it did. It's like, oh, nice.
Yeah.
But I don't think, I can't look at it and go, ah, yeah, well, we did that. You know, we uploaded here, or it was this length, or we did, you know, it's just like, I don't know. So, and I don't really care either. It's like, you know, if a video only gets 5,000 views or 10,000 views and relative to what a video would normally get on our channel, it's underwhelming. But if three people watched that video and went, yeah, I really, really enjoyed that, and I bought that product as a result of it, then that's achieved the objective, as long as you bought it from Anderton's.
Yeah, of course.
That's achieved the objective of the video. So no, I'm not driven. Are we driven heavily by algorithms and date? No, I think it's gut feel, isn't it? Does this feel like something that we want to do?
Yeah.
Would I watch that video? Is it fun? Is it interesting? Let's do it. Yeah. There are, I do know other YouTubers, I can't even say it, who are super immersed and obsessed with the algorithm.
Yeah. Or some guys like Tim Pierce will say he'll do two videos a month and he spends 2 weeks working on them or whatever to get them to where he feels they need to be, which I feel like is a totally different ideology behind it, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, ours is definitely not that. You know, I mean, ours is, and it suits the flow. So ours is release a video every day. So we don't film a video every day. We might film three videos in a day or four videos in a day sometimes. And then obviously the guys are kind of editing them, and it's all like, you know, come on, you know, so it's not, there isn't the time to do some sort of huge cinematic sort of edit on something. But that's part of the appeal, because the appeal is, what was Pete's first reaction to this thing that we showed him? Let's unbox it, go like, and sometimes I feel a bit like, oh, it would be nice to have a bit more time to do a bit more research on this. And then another time I go, why? No, the value is like, what do you actually go, oh, I like that. Or,
yeah, right, right.
You know, that's the thing, right? So, yeah, no, we look, Tim is, he's so nice as well, Tim Pierce, and he makes great videos and they're always interesting. And, you know, his tuition stuff has been super successful because people get engaged with the videos and they go, oh, he's a good player, isn't he? I'll learn some more. I'll buy his course, you know, like that. So that's his thing. I mean,
yeah. But wrapping up here, do you think you can make enough revenue just on the AdSense, or do you need some other product to sort of drive people to once they see your videos?
I suppose everything is, what's your objective? You know, I mean, could you earn minimum wage from AdSense with a modest channel. Yeah. I mean, yes. Do you want to get really wealthy off the back of YouTube?
Tough to do.
Then I think in the music industry, no, not from AdSense. No, you'd need selling your tuition material, doing all the sponsorships.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, I mean, there absolutely are some very wealthy, well, I say very wealthy, it's a relative term, isn't it? There are some people making a very good living from what they've achieved on YouTube in the music industry. But the ones that come to mind have predominantly done that by selling tuition off the back of their YouTube thing.
Right.
But I'm talking about, we're talking like really wealthy at this point, you know, yeah. Like as in, could you earn the same as you might earn doing the job that you're doing today from YouTube? Yeah, you could probably do that much more modestly. I don't know. It's hard, isn't it? It depends how much you want to do yourself. I'm super, super lucky. And I've never edited a video in my life.
I know. You said that in an interview with Rick Beato, I think. That's what you said. So, yeah.
You know, I've
you got Taylor here doing all the hard work.
I've only ever had a YouTube channel where...
You're the luckiest YouTuber in the game.
Yeah, I sit this side of the camera and just talk about rubbish. And then once the camera stops, I disappear and go do something else. So... Yeah, so I've only ever known a YouTube channel that needs two or three people to make it work. But I think if you could just, you know, it's just you and lots of these people, that's how they start, right? Just
yeah,
you.
Right.
Yeah, it's doable. I don't know. I think all the guys that are guys and girls that I know that have been successful, they all did it for love and they all had at least two or three years of making nothing out of it to get to the point where they got a bit of traction. So this idea, I think everybody wants something, everybody wants it all immediately, don't they? It's just like, that's not going to happen, is it? You know, it's like, there's got to take the long path, work hard. And then I'm sure it's the pyramid as well, isn't it? You know, everybody sees the person at the top earning the millions of dollars like that, doesn't see the 50,000 people at the bottom or literally earning nothing. So, you know, you have to remember for every one of those people at the top, there's 50,000 people. And that's, I'm sure that will be the case in YouTube land as well.
Yeah. Lee Anderton from Anderton's Music. Yes. We're wrapping up. This store is massive. This is a world-class guitar store. You'd expect nothing less, but this place is incredible. We didn't even cover the massive history of Anderton's Music, but there's multiple interviews out there, including a great interview with your dad that you did that covers the history of the shop. This is such a great place. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you very much for asking some interesting questions. Yes, it's lovely to meet you too.
Great to meet you as well.
Enjoy the rest of your trip to the UK.
Thank you so much. We're wrapping. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.